politics is really nothing else but applied morality. You see, the relationship of politics to ethics is the same as the relationship of engineering to science. Engineering is applied science. Politics is applied morality. The political question is, how can a man live his life in a society of other men without anybody trying to kill him, mug him, whipping him off, and so on? And this is why you create a government, to protect the rights of your citizens. Now, when it comes to the moral question, and this is finally when we get to the philosophical brass tack of the issue, ethics is a branch of philosophy. It is a branch of knowledge. I think I mentioned before that whenever any particular science comes under the thumb of either political orthodoxy or religious orthodoxy, then that particular branch of science will at best shrivel and become perverted. Usually what happens is it turns into a monster. And if you consider the fact that never before in history have we heard so many good intentions as we heard in this century, and never before in history have you seen so many millions of people, millions of German citizens, millions of Chinese citizens, millions of Russian citizens, millions of Latin American citizens being deliberately butchered as a matter of policy by their own governments, and not always in times of war, even in peacetime. And in view of the fact of what massive inflation has done to the middle classes all over the world, you only come to the conclusion that of all human institutions, government is the most overrated, except in two areas, that of killing and stealing. But this is because government goes outside the sphere of morality, the sphere of ethics, and it wants to do, quote-unquote, good to the people. Government is a negative force. Government has a monopoly over the use of force, and that use of force can only be aimed at the elimination of dishonesty, at preventing criminals from harming their society, from harming their fellow men. So it is in fact the ability of government that has, let's say, in clearing slums, to use a word by George Bernard Shaw, in order to build you must first clear the slums. And this is what government can do. It is a negative force. It can clear the slums, it can keep in checks the criminals and so on, but anything else, since it is a negative force, not a positive one, what it can do for a particular group of people, it can only do at the expense of another group of people. Now, when you look at the political question is, how can a citizen live his life in a society of other men? And for that you have to define what rights are, what political rights are. But you cannot answer the political question unless you first answer the antecedent ethical question, which is, how do I live my life as a human being on this earth within my own lifetime? That ethical question has always been both under the thumb of political orthodoxy and religious orthodoxy. When it comes to ethics, what kind of ethics do most people know? It's just the platitudes, well-meaning, of course, that they pick up in Sunday school. I grant you that that is better than nothing, but it's not very much better than nothing. So there has to be a rebirth, a renaissance in the field of ethics. And for that, you know, the division of labor is, well, politicians cannot be philosophers, businessmen cannot be philosophers. You have to leave that to the intellectual leaders of a particular commodity. Now, what happens is, of a particular community. What happens is that when the educational process becomes subsidized, regulated, and controlled by the state, what the hell is a school? It's a building where you send your kids and where the kids learn whatever the government sees fit that they will learn. And under that system, the virtue, the primary virtue, is not freedom, is not independence, is not self-reliance, it is obedience. The fascist slogan in Italy, for instance, was credere, ubbidire, combattere, which means to believe what the state wants you to believe, to obey all of the rules of the state, and to fight whenever the state wants you to fight, which means you are reduced to a subhuman level, to an automaton, where you are wired in to the omniscient powers of government. I remember Philip Crane, who's a good congressman from Illinois, he said, look, governments don't have a monopoly on wisdom. The people that you elect to government are, by and large, honest people. Most of them are honest. But they don't have, they haven't monopolized knowledge. They're just ordinary people, and they want to improve government. They try to make it more efficient. They want to make it more responsive to the needs of people. But in order for them to do that, they have to have ethical guidance. And I'll tell you another thing. I would be terrified if engineers were to become politicians. Because lawyers, at least, are aware.
I'm sorry. I'm trying to argue with you again.
As far as ordinary people, to which you just most recently referred, could I, with all due respect, come back to your four legitimate roles of government? You know, you accord the status of legitimacy to these four roles. But in answering Mr. Hicks at the end, and I think you made earlier reference to it in answer to me, in the matter of the survival of the gold mining industry until, you know, those bright days arrived, you saw it as a legitimate role of government to make loans, competitive loans, competitive in the marketplace available to the gold mining industry. First question is, where does the government, how does the government equip itself with such monies to lend out at competitive rates? Surely this must assume that it couldn't borrow unless it had the security of being able to pay back. It must have a taxing role, therefore another legitimate role. It must be able to raise finance to pay these debts. That's the first question. Do you admit that there is another legitimate role? But also, I fail to see the distinction between the proposition Mr. Hicks put up, that a loan in such an instance, particularly if the loan is unpaid because the business proposition fails and cannot honour the loan, I fail to see the distinction between that and an outright subsidy. But I do see a virtue in either of these two instances, a subsidy in the first instance or a loan, insofar as under our social security system, if a person is placed out of work and there's no repayment scheme for that person, in other words, he just becomes a vegetable in the labour market, there is a social conscience in the community, we provide some form of social security for that person, either an unemployment or a sickness benefit, or at his age we provide a pension. Now, if the mining industry coming closer to home is to cease to operate, and you know, the Mount Charlotte mine, our own sole existing mine in Kalgoorlie, fails to operate, those persons who are now employed, who are close to pensionable age, would go onto the pension. Those who are unemployed would go on an unemployment benefit. The national government would be still paying out under existing legislation to these people on one hand, whereas if a subsidy or a loan was available to keep that mine going, they'd be saving money on one hand but paying it out on another. But there's the added virtue, whilst the mine is operating and they're paying out the subsidy, they're getting some return by way of income tax from the earnings of the employees and the business people who survive in the community. This whole community is paying an income tax, therefore the government is probably better off. So to bifurcate the two things, do you not see at least one more legitimate role for government, the capacity to raise money by way of taxation, and secondly, the virtue in the fact that a subsidy or a loan, in the circumstances that we now face, is, in, from a pure accounting terms, in the interest of the Australian taxpayer?
Mr. Evans, if the local gold industries, the gold miners, can obtain a loan from the banking system, then you wouldn't have to go to government. I said that, all right, if government should have a role in this issue, I use the word as the ultimate lender. In other words, after the local coal mining companies have exhausted all avenues in the capital market, if they have failed in getting loans from the banking system, which is probably what will happen. Most of all, banks are aware of the risks in mining. Mining is a very high-risk industry. And gold is unlike any other mining commodity. And after all, the banks are so heavily controlled and regulated by government that if the government tells the banks not to make any loans to the gold producers, because every government today, at least any government of any industrialized nation today, for its own reasons, want to see the price of gold go down, then that will be the case. The local gold producers will not be able to get their loans, the money that they need to operate, from the banking system, because this is the government doesn't want to give them the money. So it becomes an academic question whether the local producers could go to government and say, could you please lend us some money? I don't think that the government would lend them that money. The government, I'm sure, would like to see those mines to stop operating, because there is already all the gold that has ever been produced exists to this day. It doesn't evaporate.
Do you see it as a legitimate role of government, legitimate, a competent role of government to lend money in such a case?
I mentioned this idea, I ventilated this idea of a loan from government merely as an illustration of what local gold producers might do, might want to do, if they want to survive. But the fact is, when you deal with government, when you're tied up with government to that extent, you really have no alternative but to do what the government wants you to do. Perhaps the best thing that the gold producers could do right now would be to go into some other form of mining, to leave their gold mines as they are and go into explore and go into the exploration of copper, zinc, lead, nickel, antimony, bismuth. There are many other things. If it is true that gold producers are champions of free enterprise, they realize that a laissez-faire system is one of profit and loss, and one to maintain your operations going implies a loss, then you should stop producing that particular commodity and do something else. Channel your energy and your capital into some other activity. When it comes to making cases as to why government should help a particular industry, because otherwise there will be unemployment this will cause further drain on the treasury and the government is going to lose tax revenue and so on, many businessmen can become who normally are as tongue-tied that they can't even ad-lib a belch after an Italian pizza, all of a sudden they acquire enormous eloquence. And this is the argument they use time and time and time again. Government, if you don't help us, we are going to go under. We will go bankrupt. X number of people will become unemployed. So please help us by setting up a protective tariff and so on. And then what you're doing is, instead of curing the problem, you are perpetuating the problem. So, if the Australian voters, if the Australian people want the gold producers to be subsidized, or if the Australian voters want the gold producers to continue having their tax holiday, well, who the hell am I to tell them they should be doing otherwise?
Now what we actually want is, we want no government intervention at all.
No government intervention whatever in any process of production.
That's what we're asking for.
Yes.
thank you, Mr. Gibson. That was the last question I'm going to ask.
So one quick question I might ask. Recently the US allowed the gold bullion, the right, citizens' right to purchase the whole gold bullion. At that time, the feeling, particularly in Western Australia, was that the price of gold would go up to the $200 mark, and that did, on my observation, give a lot of impetus to the hang on the gold mining here. And why was it, or what in your opinion, why the citizens of the US didn't buy gold with any excess at all, or would make any slight difference? But the price of gold started to drop, and maybe that was made available. Yet the general impression was that everyone would buy gold and put it aside, and the price would go to $200, probably $250. Do you have a reason why that didn't happen?
The legislation enabling American citizens to own gold is something that my committee fought for ever since the committee was formed. Gold ownership, per se, will not afford protection to a citizen against inflation. As I said, the Germans could exchange their Deutsche Marks for gold as they saw the inflation mount. Well, very few of them did. Another thing that my committee, that's Committee on Monetary Research and Inflation, is trying to do today, to introduce what we want, which is a fully convertible currency to gold, is the discretion on the part of producers to put in gold clauses in their contracts where the means of payment can be either a currency or so many units of weight of gold. This is something that the US government has been adamantly against. When the ownership of gold was finally allowed to American citizens at the end of 40 years, what is not known is that the United States Treasury Department, the Federal Reserve System, the Commerce Department issued in those months literally tons of pamphlets warning Americans not to buy the stuff, that it was a horrible kind of investment, that it would not pay dividends, that it was almost unpatriotic to buy gold. Even though it was now legal to buy gold and sell gold, I remember at the time when that measure was passed, I was in Salt Lake City. Salt Lake City is not a very large American town. It only has about 500,000 people. One of the most powerful bankers in Salt Lake City is George Eccles, who comes from a very, very respected family in Utah, Mormon family. It has been in Utah since the time of the Mormon migration into Utah. And he is the head, the chairman of the largest bank in Utah. It's called, I forget the name of the bank, I should know. Well, you know, it doesn't much matter. George Eccles went on the air, on television, saying that he would not sell gold, that in other words, that his bank, the largest bank in Utah, will not bother establishing a gold window. That, and then he expressed his views about what he thought of gold, that this would mean a great disaster for the business community, that it would contract business, that a great deal of capital would be tied up in this useless commodity. All of the arguments that have been made for decades by all of the Keynesians. Keynes is famous, among other things, for having said, well, why bother getting the gold out of the ground or through mining, and you have to expend a great deal of effort and time and skills. So you get it out of the ground in Australia, and then you bury it into another piece of ground, except that this time the ground is encased into a steel vault. He says, that's idiotic, that's silly, that's not modern, let's do something different. Now, you have no idea how much of that was done when the prohibition against gold ownership started. The Treasury Department had enormous guidelines that it issued to all sorts of banks, as well as investment banking houses, on rules and regulation on how to go about selling gold. All of the newspapers, the daily newspapers, the New York Times, the biggest, most respected newspapers in the country, the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Los Angeles Times, the Chicago Tribune, carried entire pages warning people about all the crooks that would now be engaged in gold selling, as if other commodities like coffee and cocoa and copper and nickel were all, as if the history of those commodities had been one of total rip-offs. So it was a massive propaganda to discourage Americans from buying gold. And that's what happened. Prior to that passage, who were the people who were buying gold? Well, I was buying some gold coins, against which was perfectly legal, as long as you bought coins that were listed in the U.S. the Treasury Department list of accepted gold coins that you could buy. A few people were aware of what was going on. And, of course, we all expected that now that the ownership of gold would become legal, that the price would go up. Sure, they passed the law, and then they made it, they discouraged, to the best of their ability, from buying it. And there is another reason for that. Since the dollar was inflated, and a lot of American citizens were buying gold abroad, this is also one thing that the American government wanted, to get gold to flow from abroad into the United States, with the long-range view that when a new international monetary system would be set up, then this gold could always be confiscated. Or if it could not be confiscated, you could always keep on attacking gold and therefore drive the price downwards, scare the suckers into dumping their gold into the money markets, and then through the Bank of International Settlement in Basel, buy that gold, take that gold away from the people once again, and put it back into the coffers.
Thank you. Thank you, I was in a circle recently where the statement was made that at the time when the International Monetary Fund put that last volume of gold on the market for tender, many people who requested tender documents never received them. Would that be a fact?
I don't understand the question. Could you rephrase it, please?
That gold was sold by tender.
Even by closed bids?
That's correct.
Uh-huh.
Yes, by written tender.
Right.
And to make that bid, you made application for tender documents.
You made up a what?
Made applications.
Yes.
An application for a tender document.
Uh-huh.
And it was said that tender documents were not returned to all people, which...
In other words, they were not published. Nobody knew who was bidding.
That's correct. Nor were they allowed to bid. In other words, the allocation was made pre-arranged.
Uh-huh.
And if that's the case, then there certainly wasn't open bidding for the gold that the International Monetary Fund put onto the market with a specific purpose for helping developing countries. Underdeveloped countries. Now, if that's the case, there's no possible doubt that it would have some effect on the price of gold today, or rather, its effect on how the price of gold has been reduced today. And I wonder if this can be proven.
I know one man who would know the answer to that, and his name is Milton Gilbert, and he is the chief economist at the Bank of International Settlements. I only see Milton Gilbert once a year when he comes to the United States at our annual meeting, and our next annual meeting will be in March of 1977.
It would be an interesting thing for us to find out, because if it was the case, it has a vast effect on our approach. The other question I'd like to ask is, there's been a term of yours, you see gold wobble up, and you see it wobble down. In which direction do you see it wobbling?
It will wobble downwards until there is until the various nations or the group of 20 or all of the nations who originally were participants at the Bretton Woods Conference decide to form a new international monetary system. The moment that conference is announced, at least you will see a movement, an upward movement in the price of gold. By that time, you see, the gold market is very, very thin. Since by that time, all of the gold which is now in the hands of the International Monetary Fund will have found its way into the vaults of the various central bankers. And whatever gold private individuals had will have been, in effect, bought by governments, leaving them with a pile of paper for the individuals. Then, for all intents and purposes, the free market of gold will be even more volatile than it is today. So that you would see a multiplier effect acting with a vengeance. You will see the opposite that of what we have been seeing for the past year or so, and gold could go to very, very high levels. Now, in that particular case, then it will be in the interest of the various governments themselves, and the bigger are their gold hoards, of course, the bigger will be their desire to see the price of gold move as high as possible. Because the more gold each central bank has, the more backing they will have, the more clout they will have in international trade. So the future of the gold industry has never looked better in a long-term sense. In a short-term sense, it looks very bad. It looks very bad because right now all governments who haven't got enough gold in their vaults want our net buyers. And don't forget the simple, elementary thing that when you want to buy something, you want to get it at the lowest possible price. So long-term, the prospects are excellent. They are better than they ever were. Short-term, they're bad. So if the local gold producers can hang tooth and nail to what they have, perhaps laying off some people and sort of holding the line, prevent flooding of the mines, prevent caving in, just the ordinary run-of-the-mill maintenance with a minimal expenditure. If they can do that for the next year, year and a half, I don't know how long it's going to take, but if they can hang on and just to survive, explore for some other mineral, do something to keep them alive. Well, for instance, I know a lot of geologists in Australia who are not being hired as geologists, and they get into sidelines. They become ranchers. Thank you. Shepherders or the raise cattle or whatever.
Could I breach an undertaking, not an election one, but I do have one vital person, I believe, arising out of what Mr. Gustiani now said. Could he please explain how and to whom do the central governments of each nation communicate from time to time what their actual gold backing is, so that, you know, some changing value can be accorded to the currency of those countries? For example, let's take the last sale by the International Monetary Fund of its gold. There's been no public disclosure, as far as I'm aware, of what actual nations bought the gold. You did explain that it was done through the International Settlement Bank,
yes.
Acting as agent for various central governments.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's assume that gold now has found its way home
mm-hmm. to the, you know, the purchaser, mm-hmm. and is resting in various central government banks. Has an example would be, has the accretion of extra gold to those central banks affected their gold backing and therefore the credibility of their currency?
No.
So what I'd like to know is how, and I'm earnest about this, I don't know, mm-hmm. someone like one asks a question, he knows the answer, I certainly don't know the answer to this one, how and to whom is the information communicated when the central bank of one country increases its gold backing of its currency? Could you explain?
Mm-hmm. And therefore to increase their gold backing, how do they communicate this information to the world at large that their currency now is more, you know, attaches more credibility, it's more a valuable currency?
Well, they don't communicate it to the world at large. No. They are even scared of telling each other. They're even scared of telling each other. Each government, in effect, is like a small-time crook who periodically issues bad checks. Eventually, they all issue bad checks. And this is why at every international conference, behind all of the outward pleasantries, there is a savage backroom fighting about who owes what to whom, because they don't know themselves, because once the currency are no longer anchored to a base in reality, it becomes an exercise in futility to say who owes what to whom. They're all pieces of paper, some depreciating at a faster value than others, and this is what increases the suspicion among various governments.
Well, could I ask one final question? If the golden age, which you said, which you anticipate, you know, could happen, and we all hope to happen, when all currencies will be fully backed by gold, or, you know, very close to that ideal, would the nations of the world then be expected to communicate, say, to the International Settlement Bank that its gold currencies are now, say, 97% of its paper-issued money?
No.
Will that happen?
No.
Well,
no.
How will we know when that age has been reached, when the currencies reach where they are fully or nearly fully backed by gold?
We will never know. There will never be any headlines written in the papers. So we will never read the story in the Kalgoorlie Miner. No one is ever going to tell you. You will find out indirectly. You will learn indirectly. In the United States, you could learn that directly by reading the Federal Reserve Bulletin of the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis. That they report, I think it is, every month or every fortnight, what is the official gold hoard in Fort Knox. Now, to the extent that they're telling the truth, that is a good indicator. But as far as everything else is concerned, the best thing when it comes to monetary policy is to bear in mind that any government official, the higher is the position of the particular government official who speaks about monetary policy, the more that man is forced into lying about the actual monetary conditions of the country. For instance, when the pound was devalued in 1947, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, up until the day before that the pound was devalued, told a magazine in England that the pound would never be devalued. Well, that magazine was published a week later when the pound had already been devalued.
But there's good reason for that, isn't there?
Yes, there is very good reason. The last thing you want is to let other people know what your policy is in monetary matters.
And what I'm saying is, when that golden age is achieved, let's assume that every country, every major country in the world, achieves a stage where its gold backing, the value of its gold backing is equivalent to all the paper money that's been issued. Wouldn't it be the first ones to proclaim to the world that we've got now 100% gold backing for our currency, if we can trust our currency?
Well, what is the use of having an international monetary fund if you don't have an international monetary register?
Yes.
That's the... I can't see the use of having it, because
you're right.
we have done away... we have eliminated some... mistrust for some further greater distrust, and this to me is advancing the reverse.
It would be advancing the reverse.
And I see that the member for Calgary means when he says the county, that it is no use. If we are going to trust one another, then we must have a central register in the same way as we have a central monetary fund.
Maybe I don't know what the answer to that is, but I think that as we move toward more honest currencies, we will know that we are moving in that direction, first of all, by the stabilization in the money markets, by the decreasing rate of inflation in various countries, by the stabilization in the foreign exchange markets. There will be all sorts of indirect indicators that will tell us what is happening. But certainly we are not going to see headlines in the papers. And when it comes to an organization such as the International Monetary Fund, that will cease to exist. There will be no reason for it to exist. Besides, every government is a sovereign entity, and there is no reason why a particular government should make its monetary matters a matter of public record or a world record to anybody.
There is one reason why nations should create a store of gold. The last two world wars, within a very short period of war being declared, Australia and other allies were called on to hand in all gold that they had in their possession, no matter what form it took. Now, it has happened twice. If there is another world war and we haven't brought in any reserve, then how do we protect ourselves? Because if this is what we meant to do for payment, then the sooner we get back to being able to free out our own soil, the better it is for our own salvation, or rather protection.
Mr. Lear, the treacherous itself, no government getting my gold.
The third question of that is gold standard. Now, is this from investigation of the 1937 we mentioned the gold standard last time, wasn't it? When was it? 35, 37.
Official price was between 1934 and 1971 was $35.
That's right, 34.
Now, 1971, or at the end of 71, we had the Smithsonian agreement in Washington. Then they moved that official price to 42.22 cents per ounce of gold, U.S. dollars.
That's what I'm getting at, is that, well, what I mean to say is that, have you studied the background of that, the preceding two or three years or four decades prior to 1934? Is this happening? Because they quadrupled the price of gold in that stage, didn't they? They had to get the value, didn't they?
No.
In 1934, they quadrupled it.
No, it wasn't quadrupled. It was upped from $20 an ounce, which was the official price of gold that had existed, if I remember correctly, from the International Genoa Conference of 1922, from 1922 at least, as far as I can remember. From 1922 until 1935, the price of gold, the official price, was $20 an ounce. Then, when Franklin Delano Roosevelt declared a bank holiday and closed all the banks and forced American citizens to hand over all of their gold to the Treasury, after that measure had been put into effect, then Roosevelt announced one day, we are pegging the price of gold at $35 an ounce, which meant that, lo and behold, within a period of 48 hours, the U.S. government had stolen from its own citizens the equivalent of $2.8 billion, which was quite a figure at the time. Nowadays, $2.8 billion would account for less than 48 hours of the federal government expenditures. So, since you cannot repeat that kind of gigantic rip-off within men's memory, you have to create another scenario that involves a psychological warfare against the holders and producers of gold, to discourage them from holding that commodity, to having them dump it in the market, drive the price down, grab it again. This is the modern, more polite, more civilized way of ripping off people. But then there is nothing new about monetary policy. The attitude of government to gold, not only to gold, but to any other form of wealth, has always been the same: to seize it, to grab it, to nationalize it, to steal it. So it's nothing new. Of course, if you steal something from Mr. Evans, your action is called theft. If you are the government and you do it, then your action, through creative nomenclature, is called taxation or nationalization or something else.
Or a public policy.
So there is a historically, you're going related to this, Roosevelt reclaiming all the gold in the USA, this is basically what you're relating it to in sort of increasing the price.
Yeah. Monetary.
Basically, what you're saying is that that's what the government's doing today, exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
They're buying the gold, getting all the gold out of the iron, in that monetary fund, in their own pockets, then to revalue it in 2 years' time.
The goal is always the same. The goal is always the same. Because, you see, once you gain control over the most important commodity there is, the commodity that every one of us past our fifth or sixth or seventh birthday, we use increasingly every day. If you can gain control over that particular commodity, you have already gained control over an awful lot of a man's life. And the name of the game in government, unfortunately, is not the protection of the rights of individuals, is to maintain itself in power. This is part and parcel of what Sam Steiger of Arizona calls the March of Dime Syndrome. And I'll explain it to you in this fashion because it's rather humorous. He said, oh, many, many thousands of years ago, when two men could not resolve their differences, they create a structure, an organization to take care of their particular problem. Now, the thing is that once you create a structure, the first duty of that structure is not to discharge the goal for which that structure was created in the first place, but it is to maintain itself into existence. And then it related the story of the March of Dime. This was an organization that was created in the United States in the late 30s to find a cure for polio. So they had a nice building, they had a chairman of the board, a president, secretaries, and various fundraisers. This was to fight polio. And everything went swimmingly until a crackpot by the name of Jonas Salk came up with a cure for polio. So lo and behold, you had the March of Dime ready to march with nowhere to go. So since the structure was there, and the only purpose of a structure is to maintain itself into existence and to justify its own existence, they said, well, we've got to find something to keep ourselves alive. Now, what do we do? Well, you see, they couldn't very well get into cancer. After all, there's the Cancer Institute. They couldn't very well devote themselves to elimination of the common cold, because nobody knows yet how the hell to fight the common cold, and besides, there are all sorts of pharmaceutical companies who have pretty much the market of the common cold in their bailiwick. They couldn't devote themselves to heart diseases, because there is the Heart Foundation. So they had to come up with an umbrella that would be hazy enough and big enough to encompass a multitude of things. So they said, well, from now on, the March of Dimes will devote itself to the elimination of birth defects. Now, how do you define a birth defect? If your parents happen to be black and you are born white-skinned with blue eyes and blonde hair in a country such as Zambia, then certainly you will be classified as a person who is defective at birth. So the March of Dime in that particular case would have something to do.
Chipson, who posed a word of thanks to the Daily for the very interesting and enlightening presentation to us this afternoon.
Mr. Buchanan, I'm afraid they've given me a very important task to one who's not very capable of doing it, but you have my assurance that I speak for everybody here when I say that we're astounded at your knowledge. It's terrific. I've never heard anybody, I don't think, in the whole of my life speak with such knowledge, and give them the certainty that you know what you're talking about. So very many people can talk capable with great ability, but they don't impress you as you've impressed us. You've touched on many, many subjects which concern us all, but of course gold is the thing that's dearest to the heart of all of us. Terribly important. I think perhaps you've given us a few words which we don't agree with. That's the value of subsidies.
That's what makes us racing.
There is a lot of criticism of the fact that our government does subsidise farming to a large degree with superphosphate, particularly. And I don't think very many of us argue with that, because food is the fundamental necessity, I suppose, perhaps more important than gold.
Yes.
Something to eat. And so I think perhaps you've got a few who disagree to some extent about subsidies, but be that as it may, we do appreciate immensely the fact that you've come to Kalgoorlie and given us such a wonderful talk. Thank you, Mr. Mayor, for allowing me this privilege. And you take, wherever you go, you take the very best wishes of all of us in Kalgoorlie. And in the future, we'll be, any time we see your name, we'll know who you are, what you are, and we'll have immense admiration for you wherever you go. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
There's no reason at all why you should break up. I just have one piece of information for you. Mr. Cutter has handed me a note that he has been speaking with Mr. Fraser, and he will receive a deputation in Canberra during the week of the 16th of August.
I would like to extend an invitation to yourself
the councillors and your senior officers to make a complete inspection of Kalgoorlie Mining Associates' operation prior to your departure for Canberra.
I appreciate the invitation, and we were most happy to accept immediately. We'll make contact with you in the interim.
Oh, no.